All right, hello everyone, and welcome to the walkthrough for our first project for CSE76, Mobile Local. So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Tommy. I'll be the head teaching fellow for the course this semester. So for each of our projects, our staff choice projects, we'll have one for HTML5, one for iOS, and one for Android. I will hold these walkthroughs, which will basically get you acquainted with some of the technologies that you'll need to learn how to use for the project, as well as kind of give you a step-by-step guide of how to approach the problem and divide the problem into more manageable pieces. So all of these walkthroughs will be videoed and put online, as will all of the lectures and all of the sections. So do check the webpage if you'd like to access any of those videos. Those should be up for the entirety of the semester, so no need to worry about downloading them or anything like that. So today, I'll talk a little bit about setting up your environment, you know, getting your page ready, and then two of the technologies that we will be working with on this project, namely JSONP and YQL, or YQL. I still don't know how to pronounce this. It's one of those two things. So Mobile Local is going to be a web application. So the first thing you're probably going to want to do is create your HTML page. So if you're using a framework like jQuery Mobile or JQ Touch, there's actually ways that you can only use one HTML page for this entire project. Things like jQuery Mobile allow you to embed multiple pages or panels on your screen into the same HTML file. And if you're not using a mobile framework, you can still do that. So no need to create all these complicated directory structures. You can probably just do this whole thing in one HTML file. So the first thing we want in our HTML file is a doc type. And this is going to tell the browser that we're using HTML5. So that the doc type is really simple. It used to be something complicated like doc type, public, transitional, some crazy thing. And now it's just simply bang doc type and then HTML. So you notice that this is a special tag. It's not going to be closed because it's just the single document declaration. It applies to the whole file that's about to be spit out. So after that, inside of our head, we probably want to load jQuery or jQuery Mobile or any other frameworks that we're using. We're going to recommend that you take a look at jQuery for this problem set because it's going to make this JSONP thing, which we'll see later, a lot simpler. So you'll notice that when you go to download jQuery, actually, they don't immediately... Or they do allow you to not simply download the file, but link to it. So if you click Download jQuery, you're going to see this big mess. And this is basically jQuery minified. So you don't have to understand what this is saying, because it's pretty crazy. But this is basically a minified version of all the source code. So jQuery is actually written in separate JavaScript files, and they basically combined them and changed all the variable names to be things like A, B, and C to reduce the file size. So if you want, you could download this file and then put it inside of your mobile local folder and then link to it with your script tag. But what's better for mobile performance is to link to what's called the CDN. So they'll give you multiple links here. And basically, instead of hosting jQuery yourself, you can actually just link to this file here. So if I just click on this one, for example, I click this, I'm still going to get this big, massive file. So the advantage of this is that a lot of websites out there are going to link to one of these CDNs. Whether it be Google, Microsoft, or jQuery. So there's a good chance that if your mobile device has visited a page that's used one of these CDNs before, it could actually just cache jQuery. So when you go to your page, it's not going to need to download jQuery again. It's going to say, oh, look, this URL, I've already downloaded this file. I don't need to download it again since it's already cached. There's also a good chance that these servers are a lot faster than the ones that you're going to be using. So that's just one... little tip, don't worry about trying to host jQuery yourself. I'd recommend linking to one of those CDNs. So in lecture, we also saw some of those cool meta tags. So things like setting the browser width to be equal to the width of the device so that the page doesn't look really zoomed out by default. And this is something that some frameworks do for you and others don't. jQuery Mobile, being the biggest framework out there right now, will not anymore do this for you. It used to, but they decided that they didn't want to kind of force that upon people. And you might even want to do something like give your app an icon so that when the user downloads it onto their home screen, it'll be your icon and not just a screenshot of the web page. So all those can be accomplished through the use of meta tags. Not strictly required, but if you want to add a little polish to your project, these are some cool things to take a look at. So other elements on the page we'll need, based on the specification, we're going to need some kind of text box so that users can enter input. So the specification says you need to be able to handle things like city, state, or zip code. So this is intentionally open-ended. You can design this however you like, something that you find intuitive and aesthetically pleasing. But note, we're not grading you on aesthetics, so if you don't have any CSS whatsoever, that's not going to be a ding against you. Or if your website's the most gorgeous website in the world, I won't get you any more design points. So that's up to you on how to handle the input. I would totally recommend making your website look really awesome once you've finished all the functionality. So other things you might need, like a submit button so the user can actually submit their query, or a place for you to load the news and the weather. And you know, all these other page elements, like how are you representing the user's history? Are you using a list? Are you using some kind of modal? Or, you know, what does the list look like? That's totally up to you. And we've left this intentionally open-ended, so you can design an app that you think is really cool and that you want to show off. So once we've set up our HTML, we probably want to have a couple of sanity checks, like, you know, are all of the elements visible on the page? If we're using jQuery, something I always do is immediately just put a little function using the dollar sign, which is basically the constructor for jQuery, or the function that's going to fire as soon as the DOM is ready. So not as soon as the page is downloaded, but as soon as all the DOM elements have been loaded and they're ready to be manipulated, you can say, I want this function to fire. And this is a good check to make sure that you actually typed in the URL for jQuery correctly, because that can be really annoying. You're like, oh, all my click handlers aren't working, and it turns out like your jQuery is 404ing, so it never got loaded. So this is one of the first things I always do, just make sure that jQuery is working. So your first HTML page could look something like this. Now we have our doc type. We've opened up our HTML tag, making sure to close it. And inside of our head, I notice that I'm linking to this CDN-hosted JavaScript. You notice it's on another domain, which we'll get back to. And then here I just have a little function. Just as soon as the document's ready to go, I'm giving this function ready, a single argument, and that argument is another function, which we do a lot in JavaScript. It's called a callback function, or an event handler. And this function is just going to say a little alert box that says jQuery is working. Now, if jQuery is not working, I'm not going to see an alert box, so this is just a nice little way to make sure I'm not insane. So if we go over here to setup and I hit refresh, it works. And that's just the very basic structure of our HTML page. Any questions on the setup side of things? Just another note, you can use any text editor you want. I'll be using Vim and all these walkthroughs, but things like Aptana or Eclipse or Emacs, totally up to you what environment you're most comfortable with. So the first concept we're going to go over is JSON. Not JSON, it's officially pronounced JSON, and it stands for JavaScript Object Notation. So even though JavaScript is in the name of this file format, it's not something that's specific to JavaScript. In fact, a lot of modern APIs that used to be XML-based are now switching over to JSON because it's so much easier to read and less verbose. So you'll find implementations of this in PHP, has built-in JSON support. Objective-C, which we'll see later, now has built-in JSON support. So it's not just limited to JavaScript, even though it's built in. So the syntax of JSON is identical to the syntax for creating a JavaScript object. So we saw this in lecture and section. A JavaScript object is effectively just an associative array. So we're mapping these keys, which are strings, to some values. So in this case, you'll notice that I have this opening brace at the top, and this is going to open up my JSON object. So all of your JSON has to start with this opening brace because every object in JavaScript starts with an opening brace. So my first key here is the string car, and the value of that string is going to be an object. So now inside of that object, or associative array, I have three more keys and three more values. I have a string, I have a number, and I have an array. So just remember, in JavaScript, when we have these curly braces, that's going to correspond to an associative array or an object, but these square braces are going to correspond to an array, so a numerically indexed array, where objects are not numerically indexed and they don't have an inherent order to them. So that's pretty easy to mess up. So as you can see, this is much nicer than XML. We didn't have to say like open car, close car, and things like that. So using JSON in JavaScript is super easy because it's built into all the modern WebKit browsers that we want to make the effort to support. We can just say JSON, all capital letters, dot parse, and we can give that a string. And what that's going to give us back is a JavaScript object of that JSON, string. So if we were to come back to this JSON string, I could now say, you know, var o equals JSON parse, and then give it this string. And then I could say o.car.color and things like that. So if you want to go in the other direction, if you have some JavaScript object and you want to convert it to JSON, you know, there's no need to like iterate over the properties yourself. You can just call this stringify function, which I think is a really fun name, which just takes any old object. It could be just, you know, the integer 5. It could be some complicated array of associative arrays of objects, and it will spit you back a JSON formatted string that you can then do whatever you want with. So you'll notice that the specification, it says that we want to use local storage in order to store the user's queries. So one notable limitation, or if you, I guess you can call it that, of local storage, is that it's going to take strings. If you try to store an array in local storage, it's just not going to work. So perhaps you'll find that this JSON stringify function can come in handy, given it returns a string. So let's just take a quick example take a look at an example of how we can actually use that JSON object we just saw on the slide. So here you'll see I'm first creating some string. And this is just the same thing we saw on the slide, just with a little bit of white space removed. So I'm taking that string, and I'm sending it to json.parse. I'm giving it the string, and now I'm returning this JSON object. So now that I have that object, I could do a few things with it. So first, I'm calling console.log, which we should have seen in lecture and section, is basically a nice way of outputting an object if you want to look at all its properties and make sure objects look the way they are, the equivalent of printfing something or printlining something in C or JavaScript or whatever you're used to. So now, although this was once a string, we can now treat it just like a JavaScript object. So we can say .car.owners, which you'll notice here is an array. Now we can iterate over it just like it's any old array, because now it is, because we've converted our string back to an object. Now if you want to take that object and convert it back to a string, really straightforward, we can just say json.stringify, and now we have back some string. So just as a sanity check, if we want to check out the output of this, so if we look at our console, you'll see if we can access a single property of this. And then we logged as we were iterating through that array. And finally, we logged a string. And so we've converted that object back to a string. And everything was done for us, including all the braces and quotes. And it's really nice. One other thing. When you're creating objects in JavaScript, you'll notice that the quotes around the keys are optional. I could have said, zoom back out. So I could have said in here, if this were just JavaScript and not JSON, I could have basically just deleted these quotes and just said car colon. But in JSON, that's not the case. These quotes around the keys are actually required, and you can sometimes get yelled at by a few JSON parsers if you don't have them. So one notable difference there. So any questions on JSON or how we'll be using it? Okay. So we saw last week all this cool stuff about AJAX. So remember, AJAX is something that allows us to make requests to another page from our own page without needing to reload the page. Right? So you know, when I'm using something like Gmail and I click on an email, the whole page doesn't reload. What I do is I make a request to the server, and I pull down some email data, and then I just update the contents of the page. There's no need to reload, and it's a much faster and smoother experience. So let's, AJAX is awesome. So we can just make an AJAX request to Google News, and we'll get back all the data. So let's just do that. So if we look at get.html, so we're using here another jQuery function. So this dollar sign is going to be the global jQuery object. Now we're calling this function get on the jQuery object. This takes two. In this case, it takes two arguments. It's very flexible. It can give a multiple number of arguments. But what this is doing here is this first argument is just going to be where I'm requesting. So I want to get data from news.google.com. Now the second argument here is going to be the callback function. So once this request finishes, the server has sent me some response, some data. So all right, let's just show me that data in an alert box. This piece should be easy. So we look at our output. So we go over here to get, and we didn't get an alert box. What we did get was this little red text down here. XML HTTP request cannot load news.google.com origin, and this is just my IP, is not allowed by access control allow origin. So that's a pretty cryptic error. And basically, that's it, right? We can't make AJAX requests to news.google.com. Looks like our project's a failure. But what this actually is just a security feature of JavaScript. So built into JavaScript is this thing that says, I cannot make an AJAX request to another domain. So you'll notice here that when I load my page, I'm on this domain. I don't have anything, I don't have a URL, a text-based URL associated with it. This is just my IP that's local to my machine. And I'm just accessing this get.html. So this IP address is effectively my domain. Now, news.google.com is a different domain. And that means that I cannot make an AJAX request to it. And so this is where JSONP is going to come in. So the P in JSONP stands for padding. And this is basically a really neat trick to allow us to effectively make AJAX requests to pages on other domains, which, as we just saw, can't just be done by default. So the basic idea behind this is that script tag, remember, can load data from other domains. Remember, we were just loading jQuery, and it was hosted by Google, which is a different domain. And that worked OK, because we've got our alert box. So instead of using this AJAX object, or XML HTTP request, which is the underlying object used by jQuery's get and getJSON. Instead of using that, let's instead add a script tag to the DOM, because we know that this can access another domain. So the source attribute, or what file is being loaded, is going to be equal to whatever the request we want to make. So if we were going to make a request to news.google.com, we're now saying script source equals, and then news.google.com, and then whatever else. So that's not going to work by default. We can't just magically make any cross-domain requests, so crossing domains, so going from my domain, that little IP, to Google's domain. We can't just do that by default. The server actually has to actively do something in order to make this work. And this is where the clever trick is. So what the server is going to do is, instead of just spitting back some data, it's going to spit back what looks like JavaScript. And it's basically just a call to a JavaScript function. So that script tag is just going to load a little piece of what is now JavaScript, because it's formatted correctly. That's going to call a function. Now that function happens to correspond with a function in our code. So when we say, I want to load some other script, and that script calls the function called f, inside of our code, we have a function called f. So now we're calling our function f, and the arguments to that function have been populated with the server data. That's pretty complicated and confusing. Luckily, we don't have to do that, because the nice people at jQuery have taken care of all of that data for us. So this is just, it's really cool to read up on. If you want to play with it yourself, you can feel free to actually take this approach. But what is highly recommended is using this jQuery function getJSON, which basically does all of that for you. It takes care of appending the script tag and calling the function and blah, blah, blah. And what it does is we can now treat our JSONP request, or our request to another domain, just like any other request. So just like a regular old request to our domain, it's going to behave the same. And there's nothing that says, actually, that this getJSON function can't be used on our same domain, in which it can. So it's just going to behave exactly the same across domains or within our own domain, which is really, really cool. So that only solves half the problem. So now we can make requests to some other server, but that server still needs to support, remember, JSONP by wrapping the function in some JavaScript. So Google News, by default, isn't going to do that. So what we need is another layer, something to go through, like some kind of proxy to go through that's going to handle wrapping the response in JSON for us. And that's where this YQL thing comes in. So this is a service that's provided by Yahoo, the Yahoo Developer Network, that allows us to, quote, query the web in some SQL-like language. So it's really cool. I mean, the queries look like, select star from, JSON where URL equals google.com. So it's just some nice abstraction here to get data from google.com. And it looks just like SQL, which is pretty cool. But what really matters is that this is going to work across domains. So basic flow, we're going to make a request to the YQL server, or the YQL server. I still know how to pronounce it. That's going to make a request to news.google.com or what have you. News.google.com is going to spit back to YQL some data. And that data is just going to be, HTML or JSON or RSS in this case. Now YQL is going to say, all right, I'm going to convert that data to JSONP. And so now, because we've made a request to YQL, and we've asked for JSONP, it supplies back our JSONP, and we have now just effectively made a request to news.google.com through this middleman, which is pretty cool. So let's just take a look at some example queries. So this problem set mentions, to try this one out. So select star from RSS, so this is our data feed because we're using the Google News RSS. We're just not using the JSON API if it even exists. So we're selecting RSS from the URL news.google.com and then /geo=02138. So let's jump over to the YQL console. So to find it, it's just developer.yahoo.com/yql/console. We could just Google YQL console to get there. And so now, let's see, this one. So now here's my query. So I just copied this from the problem set. And you'll notice here that I can just click test. And so now this is the output. So you'll notice here that this is JSONP. How do we know? It's wrapped inside of this callback function, which is just called cbfunc. If I want to change the name of that, really easy. I can, delete it if I want. Now I just get back JSON, or if I want to call it something like, I don't know, callback instead of cbfunc, YQL is going to change that function name. And so now we have back some data from the actual Google News API. So this is just a JavaScript object effectively now, because we can just parse this JSON. So we have some properties here. And what really matters here is this property results. So this results is an object. And the first key of this object is item. So now item is an array where we have some object with the title of the article, a link to the article, where it came from, and just some other information that you don't really care about. What really matters is this title and this link. So now you can kind of see where we're going. We're just going to take this data, we can iterate over it, and we can add all of this to our DOM. So we have the two things that we care about, very easily accessible, in title and link. And so now we have this, the REST query, and it even tells you how do I use this. So you'll notice that, you know, we don't want to be making a request to developer.yahoo.com/YQL, because, you know, we just typed in this, this query ourselves, so that's not really good for making a JavaScript call. So what it's going to give us down the bottom here is the URL that we want to use from JavaScript. So we're actually sending this to query.yahooapis.com, so there's just a version number. And now in this queue, this query parameter, we have what I just typed in. The select star from RSS where URL equals, and then this whole URL. So what you'll notice here is that what YQL has done for me is replace things like spaces and equal signs with their respective percent encodings. So space happens to be percent 20. So when you make your requests, this is something that you need to do. There's a handy JavaScript function for this called encode URI component. This is one of the first stumbling blocks you might find. When you construct your URL, you know, however that may be, that you want to pass to YQL, make sure that you call encode URI component more than once. So over the whole thing, over everything that you're going to pass to it, you want to make sure that you don't have contained within it anything that's not allowed inside of a URL. So if it seems like your requests are failing and you really don't know why, take a look at your URL via console.log or something and make sure that you've encoded it sufficiently. You know, depending on how you implement your URL constructing, just calling encode URI component over the URL just once might not be enough. So that was another common stumbling block. So any questions so far on how this is working? Yeah? Exactly. So this will take any RSS from any domain. Oh, sure. So let's actually take a look at what this page looks like. So this news.google.com output RSS. So let me just copy this, open this in a new tab. So this is what it looks like. So you see here that they've specified, RSS version 2.0. Yep, so this is kind of the standard version of RSS. And you'll see here a pretty effective mapping between that JSONP and this RSS, right? Remember we saw title and link? Well, here's title and here's link. And so this is where YQL is getting all this data from. Instead of worrying about parsing this XML yourself, you don't have to do that. You can just get back a jQuery object where you're ready to go. So parsing this might be kind of a pain. jQuery does make it a little easier, but it's really, really easy to just use JSON. I mean, it's already there for you. It's a JavaScript object, and it's ready to go. So this might be helpful, too, with your debugging, is determining what URL you actually want to pass to YQL. So as you're implementing your project and you're deciding, what you want to put here for geo and any other parameters you might want to throw at it, it's a good idea to actually test that URL in your browser first, because hopefully your browser can access any domain, or else your internet experience might be a little diluted. So just make sure that you're getting some valid response in what you expect. And then, maybe worry about passing the correct URL to YQL. Does that make sense? Okay. So we're going to feed that URL to get JSON, but we want to make sure that we do is remove that extra parameter that YQL added. If remember, we look back at the console, we typed in this callback function, and that determined what callback was specified here. And this is just kind of Yahoo being nice for us, because this would have been an additional step otherwise. But jQuery can actually handle all of this for you. And so if you just remove that part from the URL, jQuery's getJSON function is going to handle all of that for you. Or else it can be a little confusing trying to determine like what functions are getting called. So let's take a look at response here. So the beginning is just like before. We're loading up on jQuery from another domain. And now, here is my URL, and it's really long. You notice that this is just the URL that I copied from that YQL page. And you notice that it is URI encoded, because we don't have any spaces. We instead have %20s. And we're just selecting that Google News for our zip code. And you notice here that we've specified the format is JSON. We just want some extra information. You can remove this once all your project is working. Well, you notice that we've removed that and callback equals cbfunc. So now we can just say something like this. So we're going to call getJSON on this URL. And with the response, we have a callback function. And again, the argument to this callback function is the data the server sent us. So this is what's really cool about getJSON. Remember, I mean, the server just sent us like a function. So actually saying function response like doesn't really make sense, but jQuery has taken care of that completely for us. It looks like the server has just sent us JSON when we just saw the server is actually not doing that. So with this data, it's already parsed as JSON. So there's no need to say JSON.parseResponse. This, rather than using get, we're using getJSON, which basically the last thing it does is say, OK, I'm going to parse it for you. So if you try to say JSON.parse on this response, it's going to get confused because it's going to try to parse an object when it's expecting a string. So just no need to call JSON.parse. And now we can basically treat this response as a JavaScript object. So let's load up this page, response. So we load this, and we saw alert 10. So where did that come from? Console.log, response.query.count. And so this is the number of news items that was returned to us. We can just say, you know, dot query. Remember, we could also say quote query, quote bracket. The syntaxes are equivalent in JavaScript, the dot or the bracket notation. You notice that we've also just console.log the whole thing. So if we pop back into Chrome and come down here, by the way, how I pulled this up on a Mac, it's just Alt-Command-J. I have no idea what the shortcut is on Windows, but if you come over here to the wrench in the top, over here to Tools, and then JavaScript Console, you can load this up. If you want to hide the console, just click Escape, and you can toggle it back and forth. So you'll see here that I logged this object. Now, that's not immediately helpful, just the word object, but if we actually click this arrow, we can actually expand it. So we have response, query. Remember, we query.count, which is 10, just as we expected. But now if you go into results item, notice that this 10 matches this 10, which makes sense. And now we can expand this array, and we have here a numerically indexed array, not an object, and we can now see everything that we just got back from the server. Questions? All right. So you might find that using console.log is going to be much, much easier than things like alerts, which I used to do all the time. I fairly recently learned about console.log and was amazed because I used to have all of these alerts and different properties. But this is super, super handy to just be able to jump around and to kind of explore the object from your console. So we have effectively now circumvented the same origin policy, and we win. Us 1, browser 0. So this doesn't just work with Google News. It's going to work really with any URL we throw at it. So the Google News API, remember, returned RSS. And we looked at that RSS. Now, the other API that you'll be using, or one of the other APIs that will be needed for this problem set, is the geocoding API. So the documentation, pretty simple. Just Google geocoding API. There we go. So the documentation here is pretty nice. But basically what this is a way to convert some geographic query, whether it be a zip code or a city, state, or latitude and longitude, into an actual location. And so this is an example of the response we're going to get back from the geocoding API. So you notice here that this isn't RSS. What is it? JSON, exactly. So now this is JSON. So luckily, this YQL thing has support for both RSS and JSON. So again, we have a nice abstraction layer here. But now this is the data that we're going to be dealing with. And we can things like you know, where it is and kind of decreasing specificity. So Google's headquarters, which is in Mountain View, which is in California, which is in the United States. They didn't go as far as to say the planet, but I'm sure they will someday. And so now, instead of saying select star from RSS, because we're no longer dealing with RSS, we're now going to say select star from JSON. And we're going to tell YQL that, okay, here comes some JSON. I don't want you to try to parse out any RSS, because that's going to be pointless. And so here's what a couple of the API calls can look like. So you notice here that we can say something like an address. And so this just happens to be where I live, in case you are curious. So that's the address parameter. We can also supply it a specific latitude and longitude. And so this is where I was at the time, to a very specific number of decimal points. And it's going to spit back, despite these two different inputs, spit back a consistent format. So we're still going to be dealing with a JSON response in the same format, despite the fact that we're giving it these separate parameters. And so this is really great news for your design. So just a word about design, which is kind of the vagus axis. So a good design project is something that is not only really easy to read, you know, it's organized, but it's something that's done really efficiently. And one of the things that I look for in a good design project is that it's dry, or where dry stands for don't repeat yourself. So if you find yourself writing two functions, one that parses this response address and one that parses this response from lat-lang, you're writing two functions and you're like, awesome, this function's like the same. I can just copy and paste the other one. You just did the worst thing ever, because there's no need to copy and paste anything ever. You should try to make your functions as reusable and modular as possible. So instead of having, you know, a function parse lat-lang response, parse, you know, address response, parse geocoding, you know, whatever, you really want to have a single function that will break down the problem into subparts. So it just so happens that these will be the same function. We can just write one function that's going to parse some data from either one of these URLs. So similarly, you know, try to factor out as much code as possible as you're writing your entire project. Now, this just doesn't apply to this one case. Try to create really reusable functions that aren't 90 lines long. Well, I guess that's not bad, like 900 lines long. Try to break all of your problems down into smaller subproblems and reuse as much code as possible. You notice that in this project, we're making use of a lot of libraries. I mean, we're using jQuery, we're using YQL, and those are just the ones we've seen so far, rather than trying to do all of this ourselves. So it was once said that good coders code and great coders reuse code. And that's exactly what we need to do here. Well, not need to do, but need to do for a good design. So remember here, just there's no need to call json.parse, because getJSON is going to do that for you. So that is all of the background or all the other technologies that we didn't specifically look at in class. So now let's just briefly look at how we're going to put all of this together. And so here's just a brief list of steps that you're probably going to want to complete. In this order wouldn't be a bad idea, because some of the later steps depend on the other steps. So the first thing you want to do is set up your UI. And what I mean by that is, you know, decide what your project is going to look like. The first thing you want to do is probably not vim-index.html, but you probably want to get out a piece of paper or a whiteboard and sketch out what your project is going to look like. You know, you need to decide things like, how am I going to receive input? Am I going to have something like checkboxes or dropdowns or just a single text box or more than one text box? Decide how you're going to display things like history. You know, try to create what you think is a good-looking product. And so then you probably want to sketch out the HTML skeleton. So all of the elements, make sure they're all looking the way you want, maybe unstyled at first so you can get the functionality down, which again is what we would recommend. And then once your page is laid out, your HTML elements are well-formed and it validates and you have IDs and all the things you need to have IDs on, now then it's time to start implementing the functionality. So as we're using jQuery, you may find it really helpful to use the $ function, which is kind of the main function in jQuery. What this is going to do is it's going to select elements from the DOM. So if you're just using pure JavaScript, back in the day, the only way to kind of find an element was to do something like document.getElementById, and you could access the element with that ID. Or you could say something like getElementsWithTagName, and then iterate over all of the elements with the given tag. And that was kind of wimpy and weak and annoying. So what jQuery came along and did was introduce this way to really have really fine-grained selectors. Now, these selectors aren't just a special jQuery thing. These are actually valid CSS selectors. So if you're writing CSS 2.1+, you can actually use these selectors to select elements to apply styles to. And now, actually, a lot of modern browsers have this functionality built in. The function is called document.querySelectorAll, and you can just pass it, again, a CSS selector. But when jQuery was first written, that function didn't exist. So let's just take a look at some of the different selectors and methods that we can call on the DOM elements we get back. So the most basic of these, which is probably just calling document.getElementById under the hood, is this one. So this hashtag is referring to an element with the ID input. So this is going to hopefully give us back a single element, because IDs are something that should be unique on a single HTML page. Now, if you have multiple HTML pages and you have two things with ID input, that's okay. But on a given HTML page, there should only be one thing with a certain ID. So that's going to give us back a jQuery object. So we can call on that object this method called val. And in this case, what this method does, and is something that you're probably going to want to do immediately, is get the value of an input element. So if I have like an input type equals text, and I want to get what the user actually typed into that, I'm going to call val. That's going to return to me a string. So if instead I want to set the value of a text box, I can use that same function, but if I give it an argument, then it's going to set the contents of the text box rather than getting it. So there's no set val, get val. It just either gets or set the value, depending on if you give it an argument or not. So we can also select all the elements on our page that instead of having a given ID, have a given class. So if instead of this hashtag, I say a dot, we're now expecting a collection of elements or an array. So now this is going to say, I have this collection of elements, they all have the class row, and I want to get the HTML of those elements. Or what makes a little more sense is to set the HTML of those elements. So if you have a bunch of rows and you want to kind of wipe out all of their content and replace them with something else, we can just say $.row and then call HTML and set the value. So even though this is technically an array, if we call HTML on it, it's going to set all of the elements that were returned. And so finally, we can do a little more complicated things like this last one. That's going to say, okay, I want you to find the element with the ID news. In this case, news is probably a div or a span, because if we have a space here, that's going to say the UL element is a child of the news element. So that means that the element, this UL tag, just a side note, if there's no dot or hashtag or anything like that, it's just text, that's going to be the element. So here we're selecting all of the anchor tags, just all of the A tags. So here this UL tag is going to be contained within some tag with an ID of news. And so we can also do things like the greater than sign, which says that it needs to be a direct child of news. And we can also use the comma. So unlike the space, that's going to be the descendant, the comma is kind of an OR operator. So if I said something like hashtag input comma dot row, that's going to be everything with an ID of input or a class of row. So it's pretty simple to think that this is going to be news or UL, but it's not. It's actually a descendant. So the UL is within the news, or if I had said news comma UL, that's going to be news or UL, which would be really cool if you're factoring out some of your code. It could be very helpful. So finally, if instead of wiping out all of the HTML inside of an element, if I just want to add something to it, I can call this append function. So this is going to take some HTML, just like the HTML function did, and it's going to add it to the inside of that UL tag. And it will be at the end. There's also the prepend function, which instead of adding it at the end, is going to add it at the beginning. And the kind of analogs to prepend and append are before and after. So if instead I wanted to add something after the UL tag, so it would not be contained within the UL tag, I would say after instead of append. So that's the very subtle difference there. Append will be inside the list, after will be outside the list. And then there's also before. That doesn't happen. So any questions on the jQuery selectors? So the documentation for jQuery is really, really good. It's just docs.jquery.com. They're really good about examples and actual functioning examples. They'll show you a little source code, and you click a button, and it will actually do something. So highly recommended checking out that page. If you're thinking to yourself, wow, I really wish a function for this existed, there's a very, very good chance that the nice people at the jQuery team have written it for you. So now, just an overview of how we're going to actually get the news. What we first want to do is take this geocoding API and use it to convert our input into some location. So we can give this geolocating API a latitude and longitude, a zip code, an address, whatever we want, and it's going to spit back the same format every time. So this is a good way if you wanted to do something like, you know, a single text box. This would be one way of doing that. And it's also just recommended as better design, so you don't have to worry about parsing different types of responses, like one for zip codes, one for city state. If we just use this geocoding API, we can just have one function that parses any location that the user might give us. So once we have that geocode response, we can parse that and then send something to our Google News. So remember that the specification mentions that this nice geo parameter, although we give the example 02138, it can actually take, it's actually much more flexible than that. It can take something other than zip codes. So it's up to you to decide what you want to send as that geo parameter in order to effectively answer the user's query. So the best way to do that is to experiment with, you know, different locations and zip codes and look at what this response gives back to you. So after that, once that's working, then you can start to integrate geolocation. So remember, you know, this is just kind of another layer here. We can reuse a lot of this code because that geolocating API could also take a latitude and longitude, and that response should be the same. So we shouldn't need two separate cases here, like one for geolocation and one for city state and one for zip code. We can organize our code and reuse code such that we can really minimize the amount that we're copying, pasting, and duplicating code here. So this nice function, getCurrentPosition, which is part of the geolocation object inside of the navigator, which is where the navigator is this special global JavaScript object that contains information about the user's browser. So things like navigator.userAgent is going to be the user agent of the browser, which is something like, am I using Chrome, am I using Firefox, or something else. And a lot of sites will use this to say, oh, is the user using an iPhone? If so, I'm going to display the mobile site, or something like that. But in this case, we're going to be using this geolocation object that with this one function, we can get where the user is at. So that's going to spit back an object that has the property coords, which has a property latitude and longitude. So as we saw in lecture, it's just going to take a callback function, just like all of our jQuery, JSON, and get functions took. And the argument to that function is going to be an object representing the user's location. So it is recommended that you try this on something like a simulator or an actual device, because this function can be a little bit feisty if you're using a wired internet connection where it can't reliably determine your IP address. But maybe browsers have been a little bit smarter about that since last year. So finally, the last part of this problem set is storing the user's history here. So remember that local storage is just an array. So there are these functions getItem and setItem, but they're kind of unnecessary because we can actually just access local storage like it were any old associative array. So if we want to set a value in local storage, we can just say local storage bracket and then our key, just this string called key, and inside of it we're storing a value, which is also just a string. So if later we just say local storage bracket key, we're going to get back the string value. Now remember, local storage is only going to support strings. It's not going to support anything else. It will probably fail silently if you try to give it something else. So don't. And so using this, you can decide how you want to store some fixed number, or perhaps unlimited, depending on what you think is the best design and what the spec requires, of the user's history. So it's up to you to decide how you want to represent that within local storage. But your goal, remember, is to be able to add an item to the history and access items from the history. So I should be able to say, you know, I'm going to click on my recent searches, and then I can see, you know, where I just searched news. And then I can maybe click on that and actually take a look at the result of my query. So any questions at all about this project? Yeah?
Is the history, is it supposed to be current, or can it be at the state of when you saved it?
I'm sorry, what do you mean by that? So the way the history will work, so how does the history work? So basically, when I make a new query on my page, something should be added to this local storage like representation of history. So then, you know, however your page is designed, the next time I look at that history, that query should be in there. And if that means, you know, kicking off a query because you have some fixed size, that's what should happen. But there's no need to, like, keep the history always on your page and dynamically update it. It's up to you how to display it. But as soon as I make a query and then click history, that query should be there. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Other question? Yeah?
Do we need to worry about older browsers? I mean, do we need to worry about, you know, Explorer 6 or 7, or can we assume that we're operating on a mobile device, which are the modern
Sure, so that's a good question. Do we have to worry about older browsers? I think the spec actually mentions what browsers we need to support. Let's see. Maybe not. So our general rule of thumb is that it should work on at least two. So whether that be Chrome and Safari, which would be Android and iOS, or Chrome and Firefox. Maybe just let us know in the comments, I tested on these browsers and it worked out well. I would definitely recommend at least Chrome and Safari, which should be fine. They're both using WebKit under the hood. But in general, that's kind of our rule of thumb. There's no need to worry about like Internet Explorer 6, which people like me make the moral decision not to support. Other questions? Sure. Sure. So it's definitely up to you. If you want to get comfortable with the new Apple device, you can maybe try out developing on it. Or if you don't want to go there yet, you can stay on your Windows. What I would recommend is using the virtual machine we link to. So if you look at, maybe it's not in the spec. So you can use something like a virtual machine, which is what I do. Basically run Linux in a virtual machine and develop on that. But that's not strictly necessary for this, since it's just JavaScript. So that should kind of be independent of either Windows or Apple. So a lot of this web stuff is pretty independent, right? It doesn't really matter if you're on Windows or you're on Apple. The browser should perform the same across those two platforms. So I guess your call.
When you say those virtual machines, are those the ones referred to in here from
ES? Yeah, so right here under this bullet here, if you would like to run a web server on your own computer, install version 3 of the CS50 appliance. So this is definitely what I would recommend, and what I just did in all of these demos. That's where this IP address is coming from. I just have a little virtual machine running here. And so this is the CS50 appliance, version 3. This is probably the simplest way to get set up, since I just like having a web server. You could probably hypothetically just sit in an HTML file, and some browsers, Chrome not included, will allow you to make these AJAX requests from a local file. But a lot of browsers require code to be running on a server before you can start using AJAX requests. So I would definitely recommend using the CS50 appliance. This is what I do in all of my everyday development. Here's a virtual machine. So we have hypervisors for both Windows and Mac. So it should be the same experience across both of the platforms. Other questions? Yeah. So how to set up the Chrome development environment? Sure. So a lot of the Chrome stuff is actually already built in. So in Chrome. So basically, how are we setting up? If we want to develop in Chrome, which I would highly recommend based on completely personal. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I use Chrome. I personally use Chrome as my personal development browser since I think it's great. So where in Safari you had to enable developer mode and stuff like that, on a fresh install of Chrome, this tools JavaScript console is already built in. So if I click on developer tools, it's actually going to do the same thing. I can just click escape and get my JavaScript console. And so this is really cool. I can just evaluate some arbitrary JavaScript here. If I say 5 + 2, I get 7. So a few of the other features here, if I click on elements, I can actually see the DOM of my page. That's not an interesting one. Here we go. So I can actually see the DOM here. And you'll notice that as I'm hovering over things, they're getting highlighted on the page, which is super simple. I can actually edit the DOM right from here. So over on the right here is my style. So if I say something like width 500 pixels, I can actually edit the page without having to go to my CSS file and refresh. And so this is super handy. Another tab you might want to look at is the network tab. So if I refresh, you can see all of the things I'm making a request to. So here's my HTML. Here's my jQuery. If I click it, I can see the response, the raw HTTP stuff, the headers, and stuff like that. So for the Chrome, it's already built in. So, sure. So I actually have this cool extension here called Window Resizer. If you just Google like Chrome Window Resizer, yeah, that's the first hit. So this will put a little icon here, and if you click it, you can actually just snap to something like an iPhone. So I just clicked on that little icon here and did iPhone, Android, Palm Pre. If I click that, it's going to snap to those dimensions, and that's what it will look like on the device. So if you have a Mac, you can actually just fire up, if you've downloaded Xcode, the iOS simulator, which is currently an iPad. So if we just go to hardware, device, iPhone. So here I have a fully functioning iPhone. I can click on Safari, and I can go to whatever page I want. So that's another way to test it. If you don't have an Apple, that's totally fine. This should be enough, just resizing your Chrome window to those dimensions.
This is the actual AIM app, so this is basically how it's going to look like, whatever
is there. This is a really good enough approximation, because the Android browser is just using the Chrome code underneath the hood. So this is a really good approximation of what it would actually look like on a device. If you want, you can download the Android simulator and take a look at that. Android simulator is admittedly really slow, but it is cross-platform. There also exists Windows BlackBerry simulators, if you really care. And then if you're on a Mac, then the iOS simulator is pretty great. Best actual device is the best way to test, but just resizing the window is actually a really good approximation of what will happen. Other questions? Anything project-related? Last chance? Yeah. So is there a way to clear the local storage array, or do we have to override the elements as we need them? I think there is like some random like empty or clear method. I don't know off the top of my head if it exists or what it is. But for the purposes of this project, it is probably safest to just overwrite things as you need them. So in JavaScript, there's a keyword delete. So if I say delete and then like array and then some key, I'll actually remove that key from the array. But for this project, it's probably just easiest to just work with one thing, like one key or multiple keys or whatever you're using, without needing to clear out all of local storage. One thing I did forget to mention, a lot of people ran into this last year. When you're testing your website, make sure that you test it with an empty cache. So a lot of people basically had perfectly good local storage code. It looked great if local storage wasn't empty, which the first time all of your TFs open up your project, it will be. So an easy way to do that on Chrome is to just open up a new private browsing window. So if I click the wrench and I click new incognito window, this actually just cleared my entire cache and local storage and cookies and all of that stuff. So definitely make sure you test your website, not only when local storage is populated, but on a fresh install when local storage is still empty. Other last questions? Yeah.
Can you explain why local storage being empty would be a problem?
Sure. So why local storage being empty would be a problem? So a lot of people just assumed, like, okay, well, I have something called like history or history one, and I'm just assuming it's populated, so let's just like start using it as an array, which is going to start throwing a JavaScript error. So to circumvent that, you want to have appropriate checks to make sure things are defined, and the way to test that would be with a clear cache. All right, so if there are no other questions, then good luck on mobile local.